Hey guys, welcome to episode 90 of Photography Insights, the show that interviews people from around the photography world. We've had photographers, we've had models, we've had engineers, people who make film, people who make cameras. We've pretty much had everybody, including publishers and editors, etc. Now today I've got another special guest for you. Someone with a vast array of experience, and I'm very excited to bring this one to you as well. Now, what can you say? Someone who's worked in photography for approximately 40 years, so obviously has his roots in film and the dark room, shot 4x5, and has moved in and out of photography several times, and became a doctor in the end. So he's had a very good mixture in his life. He manages to talk a little bit about his times being a doctor and how it's affected him, and his influence of actually deciding to do it, because it all came from his photography work, working with National Geographic. So yeah, he's had some very interesting assignments. He's worked around the world. We can talk about the Russian particle accelerator, the West Bank, sitting in police chases in America, and helicopters and volcanoes. I mean, he's had such a crazy career. Now, it was really difficult getting this one down time-wise. I'm not sure how I managed to edit it down to an hour, because we chatted for a very long time. So yeah, let me introduce you to Max Helweg. Some of you may have seen his work in the Wired magazine, which is how I come across his work. Reached out to him, had some very lovely emails between us, and managed to get hold of him. So a few little things we're discussing. We've got things like Cancun, the pyramids and jail, shooting at the infamous Body Farm. We've got robots and human fears, Queen and Bohemian Rhapsody, forensic photography. We've got Peruvian presidents. Talks a little bit about the changeover from analog to digital, and what he's currently doing about COVID, assignment wise, and when it's important sometimes not to shoot as well. Now, obviously, we discussed some of the other things about his career, and I've summed it up from this little quote I've taken from the show, so bear with me. There is always a story. It doesn't matter when you arrive. Stay open. Be patient. If you'd like to check out his work, the best place is his own website, but of course, if you search for his name, you will see him all over the internet because of his ties with National Geographic, and I have put a link to his National Geographic channel as well. For anyone wanting to look at his book, he's also done this one on about invasive surgeries when he was shooting them as a photographer. Now, I have to warn you, they are very graphic. They have caused him issues with people in his career, but I think if you look at it, you'll see he's trying to capture something beautiful, and it's in all of us. So yeah, that's a personal one. So I suppose nothing left to play the music, guys. Sit back and enjoy this hour with Max Helweg. And welcome to the show, Max. How are you?
Very good, Andrew. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on here. It's great to have you. We've had some lovely emails between us, and I've been very excited to talk to you.
And I too. I enjoyed your communicating with you. Thank you.
No, that's cool. So Max was a gentleman I came across through Wired magazine. I've been a reader of that for many years, When I came across the photography, I was thinking, God, this is very different. It's something I don't see too often either. And I thought, oh, why don't I just reach out to him? And here we are.
Okay.
I mean, obviously from there, it seemed quite obvious you've had a very different career to many as well. That's putting it lightly, isn't it?
I guess so. I started in the dark room at Rolling Stone when I was 17 years old.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's crazy. I mean, obviously, you've got the medical side, you've got photography, National Geographic, you've got COVID, you've got science, robots. There are so many things that I'd love to talk to you about.
You know, when I was a little boy and, you know, got my first camera and all, you know, if I had any idea, looking through that lens, the worlds this was going to take me to, I could not have imagined. But really, it is it has been quite an interesting journey and quite a unique life. I don't know any different, but my own life, you know, like anyone else. But I feel very lucky to have been a photographer and gotten to have had the experiences one does, and that's primarily what it has been, in a way, more about having experiences than even being a photographer and such. It is constantly. Just recently, I was covering COVID for National Geographic, and really, it was a consummate experience on so many levels. One of the best stories I got to cover, and I got to use my doctor's skills. I wasn't treating people, but I was working inside the hospital and was using all my knowledge and experience along with that. And also negotiating a host difficult relationships from working in an infectious environment, highly contagious environment, dealing with a lot of issues where people were very sick and death was a possibility or was around us and or had happened, and having to work with the emotions of my subjects and using you have to ask yourself, why are you there? Are you there because this is paying my rent, you know, and or do I have a higher purpose here, you know? Why am I asking this person to give me their time and to pose for me and to take me to their mother's grave and allow me to give them direction and such. So it takes a lot of different, all kinds of different negotiating skills that I learned over a course of a career.
Yeah, I mean, as far as like your career is concerned, then, would you say this is probably one of the most dangerous bits you've done?
Not necessarily. I mean, I've been in the West Bank.
I've
been inside the criminal enterprises with criminals, working with them, and other places, situations like, that I've been in several dangerous situations, flying in a helicopter without a door taken off, what you needed to do to, at high elevations, to photograph volcanoes and such, there are helicopter accidents and such. And, climbing down cliffs without rappelling equipment, and on, you know, that you might think, well, what are you doing? You know, what the hell are you doing here? You know, did a story of, on car theft and with the police in Newark, New Jersey. And when it was, went on high speed car chase with the police and which, wow. And during, in the course of that, the car we were in went around a turn and lifted off the wheels on one side, like you see in the movies, like on one turn. And, you know, this was an old car without seat belts. I thought, you know, I was medically trained at the time and I could just see the spinal injury, you know, I could have, but that was, you know, I would say in terms of dangerous stuff, these are calculated risks of someone who's working professionally, you know, that call people, you know, professional journalists, we do, you know, and I'm not someone who's not afraid. I do have fear, but I use fear is, I tell people is your friend. It teaches you to be smart.
Yeah.
And so I don't like to bring people along when I do certain types of jobs because then I have to worry about them, but I can deal with my own situation.
Yeah, the thing is though, I mean, COVID's the unseen enemy in essence, isn't it?
Yeah, but you know, the thing about COVID is that I'm a doctor and a trained scientist by such, so I can put COVID on its I can see it as a doctor does and as a scientist does. And so if you follow the rules and if you're, you know, I took the time to become well-versed in and educate myself about COVID in doctor, websites, yeah. Right? And CDC and also in direct from Wuhan, you know, reading and from Johns Hopkins and what Harvard and other places had to offer and reading a variety of different materials so I could cross-reference and put these things into what I knew. And I was a adult internal medicine trained doctor, worked in the ICU, worked with in infectious disease, worked with people who had HIV, who had tuberculosis. Having worked with infectious disease patients before, I knew how to, and worked in sterile environments over the years. I've photographed over 300 surgical procedures. You know, and I've been working in that. I'm comfortable in that space. So I know what to do and what not to do.
Yeah.
So, and given that, I felt very comfortable working in it was I will tell you, it was an unstressful experience for me to work in this.
Okay. Do you have to still wear equipment then, or is it just a case of using a longer lens?
I used the lenses and cameras that I used. There were some situations where I stayed outside, okay, and worked, you know, and there were situations where I chose because it would have compromised the doctors, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But when the situation was appropriate and permissions were granted and stuff, I worked inside directly right up close in, you know, within patient, you know, okay, with a direct contact of the patient.
So that approach for National Geographic, is that more about what is happening or is it going to be a future article about?
It's still being developed right now because they're coming to understand it. I would say, if I can say so, I might have a better grasp of the story than they do at this time. When I went down to do the story, they were having trouble getting a photographer into a hospital here in the United States.
Yeah.
There's a lot of privacy laws in the United States, maybe more than in Europe. I don't know. and other places. And there's a law called HIPAA, having to do with hospital, something, privacy, patient privacy act, something, I don't know. And, it's a law that doctors are bound to, nurses, and it protects them that to the point where, as doctors, you can hardly even share medical information when you're transferring a patient to another hospital because they need to be cared for at another facility. It becomes difficult to even share that information to the other hospital and to the other doctor. It's almost ridiculous. Okay.
Oh, dear.
It's this thing called HIPAA, but I'm very familiar working with HIPAA, okay, as a doctor and also as a journalist, because I've been working with HIPAA for years. So, but given given all that, they were having troubles getting in, but I have been working in hospitals and all that, and I know where to go and who to work with and how to work with around HIPAA and do to get accomplished. So we went to a hospital, an environment where I could do my story, but that then got all messed up because the magazine and the lawyers at the magazine got all messed up because they didn't understand HIPAA. Okay. For lack of better terms. So that got blocked, and then it got blocked at another place, but I still had other contacts, and I was down in Louisiana where I trained, down in New Orleans, but I had another contact, and I've learned something over the years. I'm in my 60s now, and I've been doing this over 40 years, that it doesn't matter when you arrive at a story. Because you think, oh, I got to get there. You know, I got to get there, or else I'm gonna miss the moon launch. You know,
yeah.
When the spaceship launches, or you know, the big event that, and I've missed these things before. You know, I've missed big stuff, but there's always a story. Doesn't matter when you arrive. There's always a story. And you just have to, whenever you arrive, just stay open, be patient, and just keep your ears open and don't be biased. You know, another thing I learned a long time ago is that I have biases and preconceived ideas about this is going to be my story, or this is who this person is. Like, this person is a bad guy, and I'm gonna take a bad guy picture of them. You know, what I've learned a long time ago is that whatever my thoughts were about the story or about that person, I put those at the door.
Yeah.
When I walk in, and I don't impose myself on a situation. I rarely even think up how I'm gonna photograph something.
Okay.
And the magazines or people you work for, especially when you're shooting video and film, they want to know how you're going to shoot it. What are you going to do? You know, and it's tough because, you know, there's budgets and concerns about this, and it all depends on how you go about that. But it's better you go and meet someone or go into a situation first, then come out and say, well, this is what I'm going to do. Okay. And that situation might change as you move along. But so as it happened, I ended up going not to New Orleans, but I ended up going into rural Louisiana, into a rural hospital system where I had other contacts after these other situations got blown. And I had these other leads that I followed. And I was still going to do what the magazine wanted me to do, which was they wanted to do, which was the at the beginning of this, what every magazine was wanting to do, photograph a COVID intubation.
All right.
Okay. That, because at the beginning of all this, because that was like the, you know, that was the shot. That was the money shot, you know. But by the time I was going to do this, why do that? What was the purpose of that? What was that going to do? The New York Times, who I think is the greatest publication, doing the greatest work day in, day out, and has been doing that for years in print and digitally. And teaching us all how it should be done. They are doing. They have been covering COVID just so well, you know. You know, what am I going to do now? They've, you know, to the New York Times, but they've already done this, you know? But as I got into my rural situation, I found my story. I'm not going to uncover to discuss it now because it's still, it's being developed right now, but I found my story. And it was, and it took me a few days before it revealed itself to me. And even as it revealed itself to me, I started using my skills as a researcher, stuff I learned as a doctor.
Wow, that's good. It's a big thing to cover. I interviewed someone at a photojournalist magazine. It's mainly based in Europe. And I said to them, you know, what are you doing for COVID? And they were the same, that they weren't sure what their exact approach was. They had some ideas, but they didn't want to rush a story for no reason, just for the sake of it.
Interesting.
Mm.
So they came about it from the same, in the same way.
Yeah, they want to, they take the time. It's quite a new magazine. They're only about 3 issues in. It's a small team, but they cover only a few articles in the, so it's like a magazine format. So you might get, say, 6 articles in the entire magazine. But it gives them the opportunity of doing lots of words. So it's a long form sort of thing. And they have, you know, they could have 20 photos per story.
You know, people are rushing to judgment about COVID.
Hmm.
Both the governments are. And I think as a journalism, if you do that as journalism, would be just the wrong way to do it. You know, they're misunderstanding really what's going on here. And, you know, as I might have said to you earlier, you know, this thing is going to be with us for a while.
Oh, God, yes.
And there's plenty of stories to it's going to have, there are going to be many stories to tell.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. Into the, there's so many areas you can look at. Like you said, you can think about, is global warming become a thing over here? We've got to think about Brexit. You've got
the
protesting now.
Yeah.
Civil rights has now become a big thing. You know, there's the future of tourism, airfare. I mean, there's enough room out there for everyone.
I can't believe that the airplanes, when they started flying, that they were not every other row. I could not believe it. You know, there was a story in the New York Times when they first started flying again, and, you know, with regular numbers of passengers, and they talked about this big group of doctors flying back from New York City to New York, and they complained about having to sit next to each other. No fucking way would I have gotten on that plane. Once you break the barrier, and maybe none of those people got whatever, but once you break the barrier, it's gone.
Yeah.
You've broken it. And if you're not 6 feet apart, you're just, you know, I mean,
you wouldn't ride in the same car as them.
Pardon me?
You wouldn't ride in the same car as these people.
Exactly.
You wouldn't share a taxi you don't want to go on a subway together. So why would you go on a plane?
Yeah, they're misunderstanding, you know, basic what is. It's just wrong. It's just, you don't understand what's going on here.
Hmm. Okay, that's crazy.
I'm not someone who's afraid. I'm talking to someone who's smart. When you have to understand what you're dealing with here.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, when I worked in the hospitals, I was unstressed because it was unstressful in the hospital. The environment was unstressful because they were following the rules.
Yeah.
They were working. If I didn't see any. I was amazed how efficient and how well done the care was where I was working. It was the best, as in the small rural hospital. There, people were not acting dumb. Once you, if you do that, there's no stress.
Yeah.
Just because it is. But, you know, for us, and I have to include myself because I had been working with tuberculosis. There's, in a way, there's no difference. That's it's a respiratory illness. Mm-hmm. You know, we work in a negative pressure rooms. Same thing with COVID. This is a room that keeps all the air inside. Nothing will escape.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's awful stuff. It's plenty for people to talk about. I mean, you know, you've got so much you've done in your life. And I didn't want to lose out, so I wanted to ask you. So you've obviously done, is it like criminal photography? I don't know what forensic. The correct term is. Crime scenes.
The forensic.
Forensic. There we go.
The forensic. Yeah. The story that was in the Wired was on about forensic science and dealing with crime and whatever. And so my father was an aerial photographer in the Pacific during World War II.
Wow.
And he flew reconnaissance, they would fly in bombers before they would drop the bombs just to look for their bomb sites, you know, and then he would be on the bomber when they would drop the bombs, and his photographs would tell if they hit their targets. And when I was a boy, he didn't really, I knew that's what he did, but I was playing hooky from school when I was in third grade. I found school boring, and I invented the upset tummy. I was looking in my parents' closet. Both my parents worked, and so they weren't home, and I was home playing hooky from school, and looking in my parents' closet, my mom's purses for candy money.
Yeah.
To go to the candy store at the corner, around the corner. And I found my father's photo albums from the war, and he never showed them to us, but I found them in there. And there were these two photo albums, and they were of bombing missions.
Okay.
Little snapshot pictures of bombing missions. And I never had seen any pictures like this, right?
Yeah.
You know, like the pictures of bombs exploding buildings and things, and World War II were playing all the time, and there was something called Combat, TV show, but that was kind of unreal. These were real pictures.
Yeah. You
know? And I don't know, it was my father's, and it was in my parents' closet, you know, it was the contrast of being home and seeing real photos, something of my father's snapshots of the war, you know, of what he had done. And I guess these were my first crime scene photographs. They were looking at Ouija pictures in a way, you know, and I became obsessed at looking at photographs, at what they could reveal of the hidden world. You know, in a way, all pictures are like that, of what they can reveal about people and things, you know, even fashion photography or anything, really. You know, everything is forensics in a way, you know, as much as it reveals beauty, you know. So this was an assignment I had for Geographic, and I was down in Peru photographing Mario Vargas Llosa, the Peruvian author. He was running for president, and we were in the Peruvian desert someplace. We had landed ahead of him. I was following him as he was on the campaign trail, and his plane then was going to land. And I was about 150 yards away behind some bricks where I had a 180 millimeter lens. And I had a perfect shot lined up to photograph him as he was going to come off the plane. And as the plane landed, and as he came off came down the steps of the plane, and I was looking through 180 mm lens, and I had this feeling came over me. I wanted to be coming down the plane. I wanted to be running for president. And, wow. And I realized that this feeling that I had been having, this feeling of loneliness wasn't loneliness. It was this existential angst of being the voyeur, of right. constantly capturing someone else having an experience.
Yeah.
And what it was is that it wasn't that I wanted to be the center of attention, that I wanted to be photographed, but that I wanted to be running for president. I wanted to be having the primary experience, not to be the one who was experiencing the experience of the other.
Yeah.
And so a few years later, when I was photographing a woman neurosurgeon and spent 4 days with her and had this, and what the immediate feeling I had in the operating room when I was photographing her, she stepped aside and I was doing pictures of her on rounds, different things. And then one day in the operating room, and she moved apart her hands, and there was this exposed spinal cord. And she said, "Here, Max, take a picture of this." Was, you know, it was like going to the moon. And it was the most intimate place I had ever been. And that at the same time, I realized I wanted to be a doctor right then and there. And I knew that this, because this was the most intimate place I'd ever been. And being a photographer, you get to be in the most intimate places. I was on stage with Mario Vargas Llosa as he's delivering this incredible speech in front of 10,000 people while he's running for president. So I was right there on, running for president in essence with him. You know, I was with Queen, the rock group Queen, when they were doing Bohemian Rhapsody in their first U.S. tour, as an 18-year-old kid. Not even stupid.
Yeah.
With Queen, you know? And they ditched me in a town because they wanted Annie Leibovitz. I was working for Rolling Stone, I told you, in the darkroom. And that Rolling Stone gave me, this is their first job they gave me, you know? And I didn't know why they ditched me, but, you know, I was so, you know, whatever. But they wanted Annie. Annie was the chief photographer. They didn't want this 18-year-old kid who worked in the darkroom.
Yeah.
You know, but I was there with Queen when they're singing fucking Bohemian fucking Rhapsody. You know, I was in these, I could tell you countless. I was in a car chase with the New York police, you know, with the wheels off the ground going around a corner. I've been in the West Bank where they throw rocks at the Israeli soldiers. You know, just so many different places. Right there.
But none of that was good enough.
I was in high school. We were and I'm sorry to tell you this long, convoluted story, but I was in the photography club, and we organized an expedition to the Yucatan. My teacher was a wild man.
Mm-hmm.
Our photography club. And we were down in the Yucatan. It's a long story. And people were stealing artifacts. This is before Cancun was Cancun. It was nothing. And at Chichen Itza, when it rained, stuff would just come down. Paint chips, parts of Chichen Itza would just come down, and you could just pick it off the ground.
Yeah.
And after we were there for 2 weeks, and we had way elaborate plans, we were supposed to carve out 10 miles of Yucatan jungle, which is fucking crazy. But after we were there for 2 weeks, we went on one more hike into the jungle to go see this newly discovered ruin called Coba. Now it's fully open, but back then it was just barely been uncovered. It was still buried under leaves of foliage.
Right.
And it was surrounded by barbed wire fence, and there was this small hut with this Indian family living there. We gave him a few centavos, and he let us in. And we were about three or four pyramids down there this afternoon, about 200 yards from the hut, but far away from where he could see us and buried in the jungle. And my teacher uncovered a small statue up at the top. And another person uncovered a vase. I was down below filming with a Bell & Howell wind-up 16-millimeter camera when I felt something brush by my ear, and it was a shotgun with the Indian scream, Indian man, Mayan guy screaming in Mayan. It's Mayan language, not in Spanish, calling us all kinds of names and stuff, I guess.
Oh, dear.
And we were held there for the afternoon, and it's a long story, but the next day we were arrested by the Mexican FBI, the head of archaeology of all of Mexico, and spent a night in jail, and only a night. And I don't know how or why we were let out the next day, but there was some, from what I understand, there was just a macho thing between the FBI and the local police and the archaeology dude. They let us out, but I thought I was going to finally learn Spanish. But that night was pure hell. I cannot tell you more. Being having, you know, couldn't see sky and have your liberty taken away from you at that night in jail, and what the scene was inside this little holding tank filled with like 60 people in it. And what took place in that night. And when I got out of there, and I really will tell you, it was I have never felt such desperation as I went through that night. And I was just a 16-year-old kid. When I got out of there, I swore to myself I would see and do everything and anything I wanted to do the rest of my life. I would not say no. I wouldn't stop myself, having been denied freedom of every kind of all kind of having your freedom taken away from you. I wasn't going to deny myself anything anymore. I'm not, as long as it didn't hurt anybody.
Yeah.
Got into medical school without a degree because of my book on surgery, because I'd been and because of my success in journalism, went to Tulane School of Medicine and got my MD and such. And, I use these skills that I learned at the patient bedside, taking care of patients. And when I work, do a story like forensics, I can speak to scientists. I photographed the one of the pictures in that series in Wired is of is of Bruce Bedoli. He's in a lab. It's a big blue picture.
Yeah.
He's the guy who was the FBI, worked at the FBI, and it was in England that DNA was first used in a court case. It was developed in England, DNA, being used in courts. And Bruce Bedoli went to England, met with that guy, with that fellow, I forget his name. And found out what was the protocol, the lab procedures they used for his DNA processing. And at the time in the U.S., DNA was being used for paternity testing.
Okay.
Two labs, and he went to those labs and found out how they were processing DNA for those purposes, their lab protocols. And Bruce Bedoli set up the protocol as the lead of that group for the FBI for DNA sampling at crime scenes to be used in the courts in the U.S. And then eventually over the years became the head of the FBI lab, forensic lab, up until a certain time when he left. But to get to meet someone like that and speak to them, I can understand and talk to him in language, scientific language. I've been inside the Russian particle accelerator, where buildings where they built the Russian nuclear weaponry, mm-hmm. but turned in later to build the use as particle accelerators, where they smash atoms to build to create new atomic species.
Yeah,
to add on to the periodic element, and top secret facility up until recently, but work with these nuclear physicists. And I can speak to these guys up to a certain level. I don't understand everything, but because I had the basic sciences.
Yeah.
And as part of pre-medical education, and know how to read a scientific journal and use them, these things, as a doctor on a day-to-day basis to treat patients. I do science and medicine, journalism, photojournalism, filmmaking, storytelling, and I can speak to these people and treat it. I don't tell people I'm a doctor. I don't walk around telling people I'm a doctor. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And but in the world, when I'm working, I will tell people as a way to communicate with them. So we can speak on and so I've been covering science and medicine over the years. And yeah. I went off and did that science that surgery story for that led me to do this book and after becoming a doctor, which is long, long stories. I had been doing years ago, I got one odd story that begat another odd story. The kind of unique stories that led into me getting this, doing a lot of science photography. Mm. And I knew nothing about what I was photographing, but science is ripe for the imagination. It's always been fascinating. And it is even more fascinating once you learn about it.
Yeah.
And understand what it is. It becomes even more fascinating, but it's great for photography because it just there's so much you can do with it. And what I do is I try and make pictures that will draw people into a photo.
Mm-hmm.
So, so much of science you can't photograph. You can't photograph DNA. You need an electron microscope.
Yeah.
So, and there's so much of scientific phenomena that just can't be photographed, with the naked eye. The COVID virus, you can't photograph. That's why people are so stupid.
Yeah.
About it. They don't realize that there's, hundreds of particles in a cough and a spray and a speech. Mm. I don't know how many, tens of thousands. And, if they could think about them as big as a sumo wrestler and that there's hundreds of them, that's what they need to do. But you need an electron microscope again to see them. But what I try and do is to try and make pictures to draw people in,
mm-hmm.
to make them interested in and ask themselves, what the fuck is going on here? And become interested in the story and that's what I try to do.
Well, it definitely worked because obviously that's why we're talking, isn't it?
Yeah.
and it was great because obviously we were both discussing because you come from an analog world and was on about this change over to digital. And I know it was something that you was very passionate about talking, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I was working in 4x5 up until, 3-4 years ago. I was a late convert. I was in a I had long ago started setting up situations because a lot of what I did were these things like this that couldn't be photographed, okay?
Yeah.
For different reasons, different things, or I was doing portraits. So I would set things up. I do reportage. And such, and I love working with a Leica.
Yeah.
And such. And, but I've been wanting to work with a 4x5 and even 8x10, and I love the work of people who work in 8x10 and 20x24 and things like that. And I've been wanting to do that, and my editors who I work with said, no, you don't want to do that, Max. And I go, oh, okay. And I and then I'd want to do it, and I'd look at Stephen Shore's work and Joel Meyerowitz and others, you know, and my favorite photographer of all time is Diane Arbus.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. But my other great photographer of all time is Ralph Gibson.
Okay.
Okay. I learned photography as a young man by imitating photographers.
Yeah.
You can learn a lot by imitating photographers, and photography is math. At a certain f stop, at a certain shutter speed, at a certain angle, at a certain distance, at a certain elevation of the light, at a certain focal length, you're going to get X effect.
Yeah.
And I would look at photographs, and I would, you know, and I'd say, well, how much is a photographer getting paid? How many assistants does he have? And you look inside the light in the eyes of the subjects, and you can see what kind of reflector they're using. Is the light coming from underneath? Is it coming from over there? How many lights are they using? How much are they getting paid? And you can look at photographs and analyze it. And this would help me to solve problems when I got to a situation. But at a certain point, you have to pull yourself away from your imitators, but you can learn really quickly. Yeah. And I learned a lot really quickly. I mean, by 19 years old, I had learned a lot of certain styles, you know, as a young man. And you can do that.
Hmm.
But then you have to like pull yourself back. And I realized that, you know, Max, there's no way you're going to think of anything new, because you're not that smart.
Right.
You're just not that smart.
Okay.
And the only thing that you can do is try and be a good photographer.
Yeah.
Don't try and be a great photographer. Try and be a good photographer. Hmm. And just approach this honestly.
Yeah.
It's between you and your subject. And, you know, some people think that you need to let other people edit your photographs. And I say, fuck that. You have to become your own best editor. You have to be able to look at your work with as hard as you can and look at, nope. That's you're imitating this person. You're imitating that's stupid. That's bad. But maybe once or twice a year. And also, I made some of my best work by accident.
Yeah.
You have to keep an open mind. There was a period of time for 6 months, I wouldn't look through the lens just as an experiment.
Yeah.
When I was young. And I found I was not in control. There are things that happen, but if I kept my eyes open, I could see like, oh, I like that. And then I would put that in my bag of tricks. And then my bag of tricks got so refined, I said, I hate this. I can't stand it. And I had to stop it. And then there were other times I had to, like, I used to wear a camera around my neck all the time, and I was shooting a roll of film every day. And, you know, and then there are times where on purpose, I put my camera down and I would go to some place where I knew there were pictures I wanted to take. And I would say, no, I just need to experience this so I can feel what's going on here and feel that angst of like, oh, I wish I had my camera, because you miss a lot by not keeping yourself open and just watching what's there, because you're so refined by looking at things, by your algorithms, by these math equations.
Yeah.
And you see, I think that Sebastian Salgado, as great as he is, because he's a wonderful, beautiful photographer, but he, to me, is a big fake. He's an applied mathematician. And I'm interested in the original mathematicians, the original equation. He's Cartier-Bresson. Every picture I see of Sebastian Salgado, I've seen before. I've seen this equation. I've seen this equation. I've seen this equation. But Joseph Kudelka has a solution, has a theorem to Carnier-Bresson. So I go to Kudelka and I go, I look at Kudelka, because there's something that Kudelka and Diodorakis have. They have to take that photograph. They have to take that photograph. And they have to take that picture, because as much as they have to eat and breathe, they had to take those pictures. Diodorakis didn't take those pictures because I'm going to photograph freaks. And I'm going to be cool. She was driven by something I don't know, because I'm not her.
Yeah.
Not in Patricia Bosworth's biography, but I recommend everyone read that book who's serious about photography. But she will write about it, but not it. But you will not know what it is, but you will know that she was driven. And Sebastian Salgado, look, they're gorgeous, they're beautiful, but anyone could have gone to that fucking gold mine. And my God, those pictures are fucking killer.
I'll have to check them out.
Those pictures of the gold mine, which is what made him famous.
Okay.
Okay? But anyone could have gone there.
Yeah.
You know, I photographed the dead. I photographed at a place called the Body Farm. It's a place in Tennessee where they do forensic experiments.
Yeah, I've heard of this place. Yeah.
To this place. I'll spend a day taking one photograph, maybe two pictures, because it's too fucking easy taking a picture of a dead body.
Yeah.
It's too fucking easy taking a picture of something that looks like Halloween.
Yeah.
But to make a picture that's thoughtful, that makes you think, that tells a story that's deeper.
Yeah.
And to do that kind of picture, just to put it in your whatever, in your repertoire. I don't know. What I try and do is to make pictures that make people think. I have another body of work on robots.
Yeah, I've seen this, yeah.
And I've been making robots photographing robots for a long time, and people have this fear of robots.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know. And like they have fear of death, you know. And what I realized, it was when I started confronting it or realizing about this fear of the photographs and fear of robots, it was the same thing.
Yeah.
And it's what it really is. It's fear of the other. Once again.
Yeah.
And if you see movies about robots, and it's usually the android who tries to become human.
Yeah.
It gets played out over and over and over again in all the movies. You know, Blade Runner to real humans. You know, that becomes the, you know, and there's this thing called the Uncanny Valley. It's a scientific, quote unquote, scientific theory. There's a graph, and that's what it's referring to. This graph that as you approach, the more human you make your robot looking, the more people are accepting of it. But as you approach most human, people become reviled by it. And there's this uncanny valley. And it dips down to feeling like it's a zombie.
Right.
And it's baloney. There is no scientific basis for this fear. There's no science behind it. And you're talking to someone who has been with zombies. I have pronounced people dead professionally.
Hmm.
I've been in a vault in a morgue with 20 dead bodies.
Hmm.
And had someone, as a joke, turn the lights off with me, on me, you know? Hmm. But you have to realize, you know, why should I be afraid? But, you know, at the same time, I'll tell you this, you know, we go back to digital and analog. That's how this conversation started.
Mm.
I was shooting film and I was so late to convert because I loved my 4x5 camera. To me, photography's math, it's just an f-stop, shutter speed, distance, you know, by focus.
Yeah,
and I had these lenses. I had these two lenses I worked with that were 40, 60 years old, unique lenses. And I would always look for other lenses that had unique properties. You cannot use these lenses. There's no analog to these lenses in digital. You can't transfer these lenses onto the digital cameras.
No,
the math of it doesn't work. And there was one day I woke up and the film was gone. You know, my black and white printer is driving a limo.
Hmm.
You know, when in 1995, when I began pre-med, there was a camera store in New York City called Ken Hansen's. It was only for professional photographers. They had the most unique stuff and best stuff in New York City, and Ken Hansen's. And I went there to go get a modeling light for my strobe. I was a pre-med at the time, but I was still working as a photographer. And I went to their lighting department, which was in another room behind the camera room, at the camera main room. And the guy says, Max, look in that closet over there. See that guy there with the computer over there? That's a digital camera, whatever he said. He said, that's digital photography. So what's that? Hmm. Well, he says, 10 years from now, there's not going to be any cameras. There's not going to be any more cameras anymore. I said, no fucking way. No fucking way. You know.
It's a shock.
When I finished my medical training, I was in Boston. There were no more color labs in Boston. There were no color lab. There used to be 3,000 color labs in New York City. There were two left.
Wow.
There's, you know, there's a few more right now because a few more people are processing it again.
Yeah.
There were two left. But they used to run 24 hours a day.
Hmm.
There were no left in San Francisco, none in LA.
Hmm.
I was like, what the fuck? It's throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You know, I would talk to my editors that were, you can't submit film anymore. I worked for this one publication. It was a large corporation too that they belonged to. No, we're not accepting any film or only accepting. I said, why? What's the reason? She couldn't tell me why. Could you give me the fiscal or the technical reasons why? No, we're just but why? And I'm really pissed off at my colleagues.
Yeah.
They just wholesale just there used to be so many different types of cameras.
God, yeah.
So many different types. Now there's this many different types of cameras.
Yeah. And they're very similar.
Many different types.
Hmm.
Plug in the battery. And they basically, you know, variations of the same.
Yeah.
You know, they're like this. There used to be this many different types. This many different lenses. Like up.
Hmm.
And you know, when I switched, because I had to, and I would go back. I know people are doing, there are people who haven't. I know there's people who are still shooting and this or that. But when I work, I have to use a certain amount of efficiency
Yeah.
And time with what I do, and I don't have that anymore. But I hate the SLRs. I hate all that automatic shit. I just want, why don't they make a Nikon or Canon with just f-stop shutter speed and just a simple math of photography? There were photography schools that were cutting out the darkroom. And there's so much of photography you learn in the darkroom. You learn about light. And look, the thing about this is that it's not to say that digital photography is bad. It's not.
No.
It's amazing. But there's so much about what is called analog now.
Yeah.
That's going to be lost. That we learn, and so much about light and those lenses and other things that will be lost. You know, it was amazing during the heyday. It's gone. But there are, you know, what, you know, the thing is that I would never discourage another photographer, a photographer from beginning, because art is endless.
Yeah.
It's infinity. And there will always be new fashion photographers, new art photographers, new ways of doing things. And people are making money doing this. You know, it's a struggle, I will tell you, for myself. But, you know, I do work for National Geographic today. I do other work as well. And I'm, you know, at the top of my game.
Yeah.
I have unique skills. But it's harder. It's harder.
Yeah, it must be so hard entering now. I know us as amateurs, you just think, I just want to stay here because the gap to professionalism, your only option now is weddings. And, you know, we don't all want to do weddings.
You know, that people, you know, that it's amazing how many people offer, you know, publications offer, want me to give their pictures for free or for so very little. And
yeah,
you know, it's not for, you know, it's given the price of the equipment and the amount of post-production you have to do.
Yeah.
The time where you used to send it to the lab and these things. But it's been a privilege doing this, and I love it. And you still see great work being done.
Yeah.
And important work being done. And
No, that's cool. I mean, I can't wait to see your work. That comes out of COVID, I've got to say. What I'd like to say is, do you want to tell our lovely listeners where they can check out your work, Max?
Well, you can get to my website. There's a shortcut to it by going to xfilm7.com, xfilm7.com. You can find my website.
That's cool.
You go to it by my last name, but my last name is a long spelling thing.
Well, I'll put links in the show and on my website for you anyway, mate. What I like to do with all my guests as well is I do this pay it forward scheme. So is there anyone you would like to come on the show in a future episode?
You know, there's a photographer whose work, a friend of mine, I'm just thinking right now, his name is Matthew Schwartz. I'll send you a link to his work. He's prolific and brilliant. He's an art photographer. Okay. And you will find him very interesting if he would talk to him. He's been a teacher as well.
Okay.
And he's brilliant and prolific.
All right.
He's a smart motherfucker. Okay.
Yeah.
That's the highest compliment I can give you. He's prolific. And he does exquisite work. I am and prolific. I mean, he does mountains of work, and he does amazing things. I don't know why, but when you said, is there anyone, but he comes to mind, because it would be Matthew.
No, that's cool.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for telling us all these interesting stories. I'm pretty sure you've got many more that you could talk to us about.
Yeah. I've heard my language. It's just,
You know, you've covered some really interesting points there. And I think the way you've ended it, talking about the changeover and the way the industry's changed as well, there's something in there for everybody. So, thank you for being real, Max. It's been lovely to hear your story. Honestly, it's been great talking to you. I found it really interesting, and I hope I've learned something off you.
Thank you.
You take care, my friend. All right.
All right. Thank you.